I felt an ominous tickling sensation on my neck. I found that a legion of ants was advancing in extended order over my body. After a dreamless sleep, I woke suddenly at the sound of a dog yelping nearby. When I looked up above my tombstone, I saw at the other side of the cemetery a light burning over one of the graves. For a moment, I thought that I was still wandering through the halls of sleep, but then the horrible thought struck me that I might have been unlucky enough to enter a vampire-haunted graveyard. The yelping of dogs and the flickering lights over graves were sure signs of the dreaded vampire. My first thought was to take to my heels, but the whole scene seemed so eerie and unreal that my feelings of curiosity overmastered my fear, and I stood my ground. The flickering light came nearer and nearer. I then saw that it was a small lantern carried by an old man who was hobbling on a stick and tugging after him at the end of a rope the dog I had heard yelping. He was a strange little old man, like one of the goblins in Grimm's fairy stories. He walked with bent shoulders and his long white beard nearly touched the ground. His clothes were ragged and grimy, but here and there they were patched up with pieces of gaudy colours. So loosely did this ragged raiment hang on his cadaverous form that he seemed to be clothed in the garment of reeds mixed with the plumage of birds. So emaciated was his face that he looked like the figure of death in the medieval masquerade. He hobbled over to me and rasped out some unintelligible words in Magyar. I then answered in German, and he continued in the latter language.
"What are you doing in this graveyard?" said he. "Don't you know that the tomb you are resting on is haunted by a Nachtheuler? When I saw you in the distance, I took you for one of them, and I made the sign of the cross to drive you away. Look here, mein Herr. Look on that tombstone, and you will see two holes. That is the sign that the tomb is inhabited by a vampire. At any moment before dawn, it might fly forth and attack you. Have you no garlic upon you to stop up those holes and prevent the foul demon from coming out?"
The little old man's voice rose to a shriek as he spoke, and his eyes were those of a madman.
"I tell you, no one can escape those vampires once they begin to go after you. I have striven for years to escape their visitation, but they have taken everything I have in the world, and they would take me were it not for my prayers."
So saying, he pulled out of his coat a crucifix of black wood and blessed himself, muttering prayers in a low voice all the while. As he prayed, the dog kept up an accompaniment of snarling and growling, as though it was terrified of something. The old man then called out to the dog, trying to soothe it, but the beast slunk behind him and began to tremble violently.
"Look at my dog," said the old man. "He knows the werewolves are about, and he won't approach that grave."
For a long time we stood motionless by the tomb, while the old man continued to ramble on in his rasping voice and told me his story. From time to time I had to interrupt him to say that the fire had burnt low and that it was necessary to add sticks. I was terrified to stay listening to stories of vampires without the protection of a fire, for the old man's superstitious nature had already infected me, and I felt all this experience had something supernatural about it. We sat by the fire, and the old man's voice gradually droned me into a state of drowsiness, and my eyes would close involuntarily. Then he would whine out in a shriller tone, and I would awake with a start.
You wonder why I talk about vampires. My story will show you that I have good cause to fear their terrible vengeance. I was born in a village near Budapest, of peasant stock. As a young man, I left my homestead and wandered afar, taking the rough with the smooth. I fought in the Turkish War of 1878, and as a legacy was left a wound which crippled my left leg, as you see. The soldier's life in those far-off days was a cruel one, and more than once I thought my greatcoat was to be my shroud. From being a soldier, I became a commercial traveller and wandered from village to village in Turkey and Bulgaria. It was at the town of Rustchuk that I met a very beautiful Bulgarian farmer's daughter and paid court to her. I married her, and we came to settle down in Hungary in the town of Szeged. Three children we had, a boy and two girls. The boy, who was called Sandor, grew into as fine and strapping a youth as you would see any day. Vi, he was as reckless and daredevil as a young colt on the Hotobage. Aye, it was horses ruined him, for he would wander off with dealers and the copers, and there was no holding him at all. I was glad the day when he put on the grey uniform, and I thought army discipline would tame his spirit. After his service, he returned home, bringing with him a stranger whom he introduced to the family as his benefactor. He confided to me that the stranger had helped him on more occasions than one when he was in difficulties through gaming debts and had lavished money on him. Naturally, we all welcomed the stranger as the friend of Sandor, and he soon looked upon our house as a home. At first, I was astonished at Sandor's infatuation for the stranger, seeing that he was at least 20 years older. But then I saw that it was the older man who pursued the younger. He monopolized my son's attention. Not a thought would come into the latter's head, which was not inspired by the stranger. And from being a wild, irresponsible youth, he turned into a silent and thoughtful man, always daydreaming. The stranger had something Mephistophelian about his appearance. He was tall and thin, with aquiline features and a small, pointed beard. His eyes were strained and had a wild look in them like those of a shigany. His mouth coarse and brutal, with very red lips, and when he spoke, he would frequently lick them and show his teeth, which were brilliantly white and sharply pointed like those of a dog or wolf. He was the life and soul of our family, for he had a soft, caressing manner, in spite of his sudden fits of passion, when his eyes would blaze and he would show his canine teeth. He would come and visit us in the afternoon and delight us by his many accomplishments. He was the man of the world, and we were the humble village folk whom he was pleased to honor. There was something fantastic about the stranger, who traveled all the world enduring exciting adventures, and Yulska, my eldest daughter, would call him the Fairy Prince, and she said that he was sent to our house by the Dalibab, or Fata Morgana. We never knew when he would come, for he gave us no warning of his arrival in the town. He seemed to glide in unperceived, and after some days of consecutive visits, he would suddenly depart on the pretext of urgent business. I could never find out what his business was, for he contented himself with telling me that he had to travel far and wide. As time went on, Yulska became more and more attracted towards him. She would sit for hours listening to his stories of travels, and he seemed to hypnotize her by his cold, piercing grey eyes. Everything about the mysterious stranger thrilled her. His brown, close-fitting squire's costume, his polished top boots, his purple necktie, which gave him the air of an Oriental prince, his long, white fingers like those of a woman, with sharp nails cut to a point. Poor Yulska, she was distracted with love for her cavalier, and she would confess to me with tears in her eyes that she loved him madly. But she was always terrified lest he might one day vanish away into the distance like Lohengrin on his fairy swan. My wife had always looked with misgivings on the stranger in spite of all his charm. "He is an adventurer," she cried, "and he will seduce our Yulska and then depart in the night like a thief." In my mind I agreed with her, but I sympathized with Yulska. When we tried to reason with Yulska, there were tears and lamentations. I could see she was hopelessly infatuated, and I was afraid she might do something desperate. The best course seemed to me to say farewell to the stranger and forbid him to visit our house any more. Our leave-taking was stormy, and I saw a look of demoniacal hate in his grey eyes, and his mouth was twisted into a grimace of sardonic triumph. In order to distract Yulska's thoughts from her sufferings, we closed our house and went to live for a while in the country near Temeshvar. One night, when all the household had retired to rest and all was as still as the grave, I heard the sound of horses' hoofs clattering on the road. The night was dark and misty, but when I looked out the window, I saw dimly in the distance a carriage drawn by four black horses galloping away in a cloud of dust. I was naturally superstitious, and the sight of those four black horses paralyzed me with horror, for I knew they were of evil omen. My first impulse was to rush into Jaska's room. She was not there. The bed was tossed and one of the sheets twisted into a rope hung from the window. On the table, I found a note saying, "Dearest father and mother, forgive me for what I am doing and pray for my soul, Jaska." I cannot describe for you the grief of all of us. We searched high and low. We informed the police. We searched the country for miles around, but no definite news did we get of Jaska. And so often happens in such cases of disappearance. Many came forward to say they had seen her here or there, accompanied by an elderly man. But the clues led to nothing. As for my wife, she was convinced that Jaska had been carried away by a vampire, and what agonized her more than the loss of her eldest daughter was the terrifying thought that Jaska, if she once came into the power of a vampire, would turn into one herself. "The stranger was a vampire," she cried. "Did you notice his pointed teeth, his red lips?" The four black horses were his, and he now possesses her body and soul. When he has sucked her blood, she will become as he is and haunt us to our ruin. She spent her whole day in prayer. Each moment she thought she heard poor Jaska crying out, and she fancied that Jaska would appear in the night in the form of a bat, to haunt her remaining daughter Sari, or else Sandor. She hung crucifixes in every room, and at the night she would insist on hanging garlic leaves over Sari's and Sandor's bed to protect them. Her mind gave way, and she would wander aimlessly round the house with a vacant stare on her face, calling out Jaska's name and blessing herself as though to exorcise her. Some months after that, I followed her hearse to the cemetery. As for Sandor, he left home after his mother's death, and I was left alone with Sari in our house of mourning. From time to time, Sandor wrote to me telling me of his life. He had obtained employment as a clerk in an office in Budapest, and from his letters I inferred that he was satisfied with his humdrum life. Then, for a long time, I had no news of him, until one day a letter came telling me to go at once to him, as he was seriously ill. When I arrived at Budapest, I went straight to his lodgings and I found him lying in a filthy room, looking as if he would die any minute. He was as white as a sheet and he could just open his eyes and give me a sad, weary smile. The doctor, who was standing by his bedside, told me that Sandor had not many days to live, for he was in the last stages of galloping consumption. All the life seemed to be ebbing fast from my son. At times he would cry out faintly for Jaska, and he told me of a strange dream he had had. He dreamt he met her outside the arched gate of a city, and she stood within the arch and beckoned to enter. She was dressed in dazzling white and looked radiantly beautiful and happy, but her face was as white as her dress, and her lips were like a scarlet wound. She beckoned again and again to him, but though he strove hard, he was unable to cross the threshold of the gate. Then he awoke in a state of terrible anguish, and he felt so weak that he thought he was going to die. He could not understand the reason why he felt so sad, for the dream had been a happy one, and Jaska had seemed so radiant. Night after night the dream repeated itself, and on each awakening he would feel the sense of overwhelming weakness. Then, one night in the dream, she had drawn him through the arch and he had followed her through the town and along a road until they came to a clump of trees where he saw tombstones dotted about. Sandor used to rave for hours incoherently, trying to recall the place where he had seen the tombstones. "If I could only remember the name, I should know where to find Jaska," he cried. Each day he became weaker, in spite of the doctor's treatment and the drugs that he consumed. But I knew that all the medicine in the world would be of no avail, for it was Yulska's spirit which was consuming him. Just as my dear wife had done, I placed garlic plants about his bed and a crucifix over his head. At night I never left him alone, and I would watch him tossing about in the bed, trying in vain to find peace. There was a look of wild yearning in his face, and he would mutter the name of Yulska again and again. I knew that he was hypnotized by her spirit as a hummingbird is by the snake's eye. Every prayer that came into my mind I said over him, and every incantation I had learned from old gypsy woman, but it was in vain. At a certain moment of the night I would feel drowsy, and a mist would gather before my eyes. After dozing off momentarily, I would awake. Sandor would be sleeping peacefully, but his face would look still more deathly than before, and from the corners of his mouth I saw a thin stream of blood trickle down his white neck. Each hour I watched by his deathbed became more terrifying than the last, for I watched him gradually change from my poor dying son into the deathless vampire, ready to work evil on others. Then, one night in the midst of a troubled sleep, he suddenly shrieked out, "The tombstones! The tombstones! I know where they are! I can see the trees and the low wall. The name of the town is Lebsini. Go through the town and then along the road mile after mile until you come to the graveyard." When he awoke, he was so exhausted that he would not speak, and he did not remember his dream. But my mind was made up. I determined to seek out the graveyard and discover Yulska's tomb and rid the world of the terrible vampire. After handing over the care of Sandor to a trusted relative, I set out from Budapest, accompanied by an old gypsy woman I had known for many years. She was to be my confederate in the grim task which lay before me. She was one of the Kalhali, as the gypsies called the witches in Hungary, and as we tramped along the road she muttered incantations in the intervals of giving me advice how to rid myself of the vampire pest. When we reached Lebsini, we turned back along the road, and after a weary search, we came to this cemetery where you and I are seated now, and I discovered that it tallied with the description my son had given in his dream. Tomb after tomb we examined, and after a long search we came to one in a corner, on whose stone the name Yulska was engraved in big letters. She had died the year before. How had she died? Who had closed her eyes? Did she die in poverty? And if so, who had raised the tombstone over her grave? Who knows? The night after I had discovered the grave, I returned with the old woman to carry out my grim task of liberation. It was a stormy night. The wind was whistling through the trees, and rain and sleet lashed our faces. No moon was shining, and I thanked God for that. A moon would have exposed our sinister work and perhaps drawn the suspicious peasantry after us. At midnight, I started to dig down into the grave while the old woman stood by and muttered incantations. After digging for some time, I knocked with my spade against the coffin. The sound of the spade striking the coffin filled me with such horror that I nearly fainted, but the old woman called sternly for me to break open the lid with the spade. With difficulty I did as she commanded, and when I had wrenched open the lid I gazed on all that remained of my poor Yulska. For a moment I thought I was the victim of an hallucination, for Yulska looked as if she were sleeping peacefully. Over her eyes there was spread a filmy substance, and her lips were bright red, as though she had recently fed on a loathsome repast in the land of the living. Again I hesitated, for my eyes were riveted on the corpse in the coffin. Again the old woman's sharp voice broke in upon my meditation. "Make haste and use this knife. You must cut off her head and bury it in another part of the cemetery. If you do that, her spirit will trouble you and your family no more." The old hag, with these words, handed me a sharp knife she had brought with her, and straightway began to gather twigs to make a fire nearby. Hardening my heart, I tried to do her bidding, but my strength failed me. The witch then seized the knife from my hands and with one slash severed the head from the trunk. I shut my eyes, but it seemed to me as if the corpse moaned and the blood spurted over me. After fastening down the coffin lid and piling the earth over it, we buried the head in the opposite side of the cemetery, and we departed on our way towards Budapest. Before she took leave of me, the old woman said, "Be sure to go back to that cemetery and pour wine on the grave of your daughter, for there is nothing like wine for laying the ghost to rest." When I reached my son's bedside, I found him at death's door. But he had no longer the vile look in his eye, only a serene peace. And he was just able to beg my prayers before he died. I buried him in the same cemetery as his sister, and once every month I come to the two graves. Tonight, when I came in here and I was frightened when I saw the fire, I was afraid someone might have discovered my secret. The old man, after finishing his story, led me over to the opposite side of the graveyard, where he pointed to a recently erected tombstone, and on it I read the name Sandor. Dawn was now breaking, and the air was grey and misty. The old man, pulling his dog after him, and I made our way out of the cemetery. At the top of the hill, I saw a woman coming towards us. The old man said to me when he saw her, "There is my daughter Sari. She always comes to fetch me after my long night's vigil." The woman, when she came near us, ran up to the old man and kissed him. I then saw them depart on their way towards Lepsini.
Will, by Vincent O'Sullivan. Vincent O'Sullivan, 1868-1940, was born to a wealthy family in New York City and attended Columbia Grammar School, then moved to England and studied at Oxford. In 1894, he began to contribute stories and poems to the Senate magazine, resulting in a collection of poems. In 1896, A Book of Bargains, one of the most important early collections of supernatural fiction, was published by his friend Leonard Smithers, a key figure in the Yellow Book decade of the 1890s. O'Sullivan was the only American of significance in the aesthetic movement, which was led by Aubrey Beardsley, Oscar Wilde, and Ernest Dowson. Like that of so many of his circle, O'Sullivan's work was filled with morbidity and decadence. O'Sullivan used his wealth to help friends, notably Wilde after his release from prison, and it was eventually dissipated. Of his friend O'Sullivan, Wilde once wrote that he is really very pleasant for one who treats life from the standpoint of the tomb. The strong negative reaction to his support of the despised Wilde resulted in a largely closed market for O'Sullivan's work. He was reduced to dire poverty late in life, and died in a pauper's ward in Paris shortly after the German occupation. Will was first published in book form in The Green Window, London, Leonard Smithers, 1899.
Will, by Vincent O'Sullivan. Read by Paul Michael. Part 1. Have the dead still power after they are laid in the earth? Do they rule us by the power of the dead from their awful thrones? Do their closed eyes become menacing beacons, and their paralyzed hands reach out to scourge our feet into the paths which they have marked out? Ah, surely when the dead are given to the dust, their power crumbles into the dust. Often during the long summer afternoons, as they sat together in a deep window looking out at the park of the somber fountains, he thought of these things, for it was at the hour of sundown when the gloomy house was splashed with crimson that he most hated his wife. They had been together for some months now, and their days were always spent in the same manner, seated in the window of a great room with dark oak furniture, heavy tapestry, and rich purple hangings, in which a curious decaying scent of lavender ever lingered. For an hour at a time he would stare at her intensely as she sat before him, tall and pale and fragile, with her raven hair sweeping about her neck and her languid hands turning over the leaves of an illuminated missal. And then he would look once more at the park of the somber fountains, where the river lay, like a silver dream at the end. At sunset the river became for him turbulent and boding, a pool of blood, and the trees, clad in scarlet, brandished flaming swords. For long days they sat in that room, always silent, watching the shadows turn from steel to crimson, from crimson to gray, from gray to black. If by rare chance they wandered abroad and moved beyond the gates of the Park of the Somber Fountains, he might hear one passenger say to another, "How beautiful she is!" And then his hatred of his wife increased a hundredfold. So he was poisoning her, surely and lingeringly, with a poison more wily and subtle than that of Cesare Borgia's ring, with a poison distilled in his eyes. He was drawing out her life as he gazed at her, draining her veins, grudging the beats of her heart. He felt no need of the slow poisons which wither the flesh, of the dread poisons which set fire to the brain, for his hate was a poison which he poured over her white body till it would no longer have the strength to hold back the escaping soul. With exultation he watched her growing weaker and weaker as the summer glided by. Not a day, not an hour passed that she did not pay toll to his eyes. And when in the autumn there came upon her two long faints which resembled catalepsy, he fortified his will to hate, for he felt that the end was at hand. At length, one evening, when the sky was gray in a winter sunset, she lay on a couch in the dark room, and he knew she was dying. The doctors had gone away with death on their lips, and they were left, for the moment, alone. Then she called him to her side from the deep window where he was seated looking out over the Park of the Somber Fountains.
"You have your will," she said. "I am dying."
"My will," he murmured, waving his hands.
"Hush," she moaned. "Do you think I do not know? For days and months I have felt you drawing the life of my body into your life, that you might spill my soul on the ground. For days and months, as I have sat with you, as I have walked by your side, you have seen me imploring pity. But you relented not, and you have your will. For I am going down to death. You have your will, and my body is dead. But my soul cannot die."
"No,"
she cried, raising herself a little on the pillows.
"My soul shall not die, but live, and sway an all-touching scepter lighted at the stars.
My wife,
you have thought to live without me, but you will never be without me. Through long nights when the moon is hid, through dreary days when the sun is dulled, I shall be at your side. In the deepest chaos illumined by lightning, on the loftiest mountaintop, do not seek to escape me. You are my bondman, for this is the compact I have made with the cardinals of death."
At the noon of night, she died, and 2 days later they carried her to a burying place set about a ruined abbey, and there they laid her in the grave. When he had seen her buried, he left the Park of the Somber Fountains and traveled to distant lands. He penetrated the most unknown and difficult countries. He lived for months amid Arctic seas. He took part in tragic and barbarous scenes. He used himself to the sights of cruelty and terror, to the anguish of women and children, to the agony and fear of men. And when he returned after years of adventure, he went to live in a house the windows of which overlooked the ruined abbey and the grave of his wife. Even as the window where they had erewhile sat together overlooked the Park of the Somber Fountains. And here he spent dreaming days and sleepless nights, nights painted with monstrous and tumultuous pictures, and moved by waking dreams. Phantoms, haggard and ghastly, swept before him. Ruined cities covered with a cold light edified themselves in his room. While in his ears resounded the trample of retreating and advancing armies, the clangor of squadrons, and noise of breaking war. He was haunted by women who prayed him to have mercy, stretching out beseeching hands. Always women, and sometimes they were dead. And when the day came at last and his tired eyes reverted to the lonely grave, he would soothe himself with some eastern drug and let the hours slumber by as he fell into long reveries, murmuring at times to himself the rich, sonorous, lulling cadences of the poems in prose of Baudelaire, or dim meditative phrases laden with the mysteries of the inner rooms of life and death from the pages of Sir Thomas Browne. On a night which was the last of the moon, he heard a singular scraping noise at his window, and upon throwing open the casement he smelt the heavy odor which clings to vaults and catacombs where the dead are entombed. Then he saw that a beetle enormous and unreal, had crept up the wall of his house from the graveyard, and was now crawling across the floor of his room. With marvelous swiftness it climbed on a table placed near a couch on which he was used to lie, and as he approached, shuddering with loathing and disgust, he perceived to his horror that it had two red eyes like spots of blood. Sick with hatred of the thing as he was, those eyes fascinated him, held him like teeth. That night his other visions left him, but the beetle never let him go, nay, compelled him, as he sat weeping and helpless, to study its hideous conformation, to dwell upon its fangs, to ponder on its food. All through the night that was like a century, all through the pulsing hours, did he sit oppressed with horror, gazing at that unutterable slimy vermin. At the first streak of dawn it glided away, leaving in its trail the same smell of the charnel house. But to him the day brought no rest, for his dreams were haunted by the abominable thing. All day in his ears a music sounded, a music thronged with passion and wailing of defeat, funereal and full of great alarms. All day he felt that he was engaged in a conflict with one in armor, while he himself was unharnessed and defenseless. All day till the dark night came, when he observed the abhorred monster crawling slowly from the ruined abbey, and the calm, neglected Golgotha which lay there in his sight, calm outwardly, but beneath perhaps, how disturbed, how swept by tempest. With trepidation, with a feeling of inexpiable guilt, he awaited the worm, the messenger of the dead. And this night and day were the type of nights and days to come. From the night of the new moon, indeed, till the night when it began to wane, the beetle remained in the grave. But so awful was the relief of those hours, the transition so poignant, that he could do nothing but shudder in a depression as of madness. And his circumstances were not merely those of physical horror and disgust. Clouds of spiritual fear enveloped him. He felt that this abortion, this unspeakable visitor, was really an agent that claimed his life, and the flesh fell from his bones. So did he pass each day, looking forward with anguish to the night, and then at length came the distorted night full of overwhelming anxiety and pain. Part 2. At dawn, when the dew was still heavy on the grass, he would go forth into the graveyard and stand before the iron gates of the vault in which his wife was laid. And as he stood there, repeating wild litanies of supplication, he would cast into the vault things of priceless value, skins of man-eating tigers and of leopards, skins of beasts that drank from the Ganges, and of beasts that wallowed in the mud of the Nile, gems that were the ornament of the pharaohs, tusks of elephants and corals that men had given their lives to obtain. Then holding up his arms, in a voice that raged against heaven, he would cry, "Take these, O avenging soul, and leave me in quiet. Are these not enough?" And after some weeks he came to the vault again, bringing with him a consecrated chalice studded with jewels, which had been used by a priest at Mass, and a ciborium of the purest gold. These he filled with the rare wine of a lost vintage, and placing them within the vault he called in a voice of storm, "Take these, O implacable soul, and spare thy bondmen. Are these not enough?" At last he brought with him the bracelets of the woman he loved, whose heart he had broken by parting with her to propitiate the dead. He brought a long strand of her hair and a handkerchief damp with her tears, and the vault was filled with the misery of his heart-quaking whisper, "O my wife, are not these enough?" But it became plain to those who were about him that he had come to the end of his life. His hatred of death, his fear of its unyielding caress, gave him strength, and he seemed to be resisting with his thin hands some palpable assailant. Plainer and more deeply colored than the visions of delirium, he saw the company which advanced to combat him. In the strongest light he contemplated the scenery which surrounds the portals of dissolution. And at the supreme moment, It was with a struggle far greater than that of the miser who is forcibly parted from his gold, with an anguish far more intense than that of the lover who is torn from his mistress, that he gave up his soul. On a shrewd, gray evening in the autumn, they carried him down to bury him in the vault by the side of his wife. This he had desired, for he thought that in no other vault, however dark, would the darkness be quite still. In no other resting place would he be allowed to repose. As they carried him, they intoned a majestic threnody, a chant which had the deep tramp and surge of a triumphant march, which rode on the winds and sobbed through the boughs of ancient trees. And having come to the vault, they gave him to the grave, and knelt on the ground to pray for the ease of his spirit. Requiem aeternum dona ei Domine. But as they prepared to leave the precincts of the ruined abbey, a dialogue began within the vault. A dialogue so wonderful, so terrible in its nature, its cause, that as they hearkened, they gazed at one another in the twilight with wry and pallid faces. And first a woman's voice. "You are come." "Yes, I am come," said the voice of a man. "I yield myself to you, the conqueror." "Long have I awaited you," said the woman's voice. "For years I have lain here while the rain soaked through the stones and snow was heavy on my breast. For years while the sun danced over the earth and the moon smiled her mellow smile upon gardens and pleasant things, I have lain here in the company of the worm, and I have leagued with the worm. You did nothing but what I willed. You were the toy of my dead hands. Ah, you stole my body from me, but I have stolen your soul from you." "And is there peace for me now, at the last?" The woman's voice became louder and rang through the vault like a proclaiming trumpet. "Peace is not mine. You and I are at last together in the city of one who queens it over a mighty empire. Now we shall tremble before the Queen of Death." The watchers flung aside the gates of the vault and struck open two coffins. In a moldy coffin, they found the body of a woman, having the countenance and warmth of one who has just died. But the body of the man was corrupt and most horrid, like a corpse that has lain for years in a place of graves.
Bloodlust by Dion Fortune. Violet Mary Firth, 1890 to 1946, took the pseudonym Dion Fortune from the family motto, Deo non fortuna, God not fate. Born in Llandunno, North Wales, Firth was the daughter of parents active in the Christian Science and Garden City movements. She became a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, but left to found another society, the Fraternity of the Inner Light. Her interest in spiritualism and the occult was largely the result of encountering Dr. Theodore Moriarty, who became the inspiration for a series of stories about Dr. Taverner, a psychic detective much in the manner of Sherlock Holmes, whose adventures are narrated by his Watson-like assistant, Dr. Rhodes. The Secrets of Dr. Taverner was her first work of fiction, though she had written and continued to write articles, books, and pamphlets on such subjects as spiritualism, vegetarianism, and contraception. Each Taverner story explores occult, magical, and psychological subjects, depicting a mystical path of life that passes through both good and evil veils of existence. Her fiction dealt with the lost city of Atlantis, the great god Pan, astral bodies, and reincarnation. When she died, her last novel, Moon Magic, was incomplete, but the final two chapters were reportedly dictated from beyond to one of the inner light mediums. Bloodlust was first published in The Secrets of Dr. Taverner, London, Douglas, 1926.
Bloodlust by Dion Fortune, read by Steve West. Part 1. I've never been able to make up my mind whether Dr. Taverner should be the hero or the villain of these histories. That he was a man of the most selfless ideals could not be questioned, but in his methods of putting those ideals into practice, he was absolutely unscrupulous. He did not evade the law, he merely ignored it. and though the exquisite tenderness with which he handled his cases was an education in itself, yet he would use that wonderful psychological method of his to break a soul to pieces, going to work as quietly and methodically and benevolently as if bent upon the cure of his patient. The manner of my meeting with this strange man was quite simple. After being gazetted out of the RAMC, I went to a medical agency and inquired what posts were available. I said, "I've come out of the army with my nerves shattered. I want some quiet place till I can pull myself together." "So does everybody else," said the clerk. He looked at me thoughtfully. "I wonder whether you would care to try a place we have had on our books for some time. We have sent several men down to it, but none of them would stop." He sent me round to one of the tributaries of Harley Street, and there I made the acquaintance of the man who, whether he was good or bad, I have always regarded as the greatest mind I ever met. Tall and thin, with a parchment-like countenance, he might have been any age from 35 to 65. I've seen him look both ages within the hour. He lost no time in coming to the point. "I want a medical superintendent for my nursing home," he told me. "I understand that you have specialized, as far as the army permitted you to, in mental cases. I'm afraid you will find my methods very different from the orthodox ones. However, as I sometimes succeed where others fail, I consider I am justified in continuing to experiment, which I think, Dr. Rhodes, is all any of my colleagues can claim to do." The man's cynical manner annoyed me, though I could not deny that mental treatment is not an exact science at the present moment. As if in answer to my thought, he continued, "My chief interest lies in those regions of psychology which orthodox science has not as yet ventured to explore. You work with me, you will see some queer things, but all I ask of you is that you should keep an open mind and a shut mouth." This I undertook to do, for although I shrank instinctively from the man, yet there was about him such a curious attraction, such a sense of power and adventurous research, that I determined at least to give him the benefit of the doubt and see what it might lead to. His extraordinarily stimulating personality, which seemed to key my brain to concert pitch, made me feel that he might be a good tonic for a man who had lost his grip on life for the time being. "Unless you have elaborate packing to do," he said, "I can motor you down to my place. If you will walk over with me to the garage, I will drive you round to your lodgings, pick up your things, and we shall get in before dark." We drove at a pretty high speed down the Portsmouth Road till we came to Thursley, and then, to my surprise, my companion turned off to the right and took the big car by a cart track over the heather. "This is Thorsley, or field," he said, as the blighted country unrolled before us. "The old worship is still kept up here."
"The Catholic faith?" I inquired.
"The Catholic faith, my dear sir, is an innovation. I was referring to the pagan worship. The peasants about here still retain bits of the old ritual. They think that it brings them luck or some such superstition. They have no knowledge of its inner meaning."
He paused a moment, and then turned to me and said with extraordinary emphasis,
"Have you ever thought what it would mean if a man who had the knowledge could piece that ritual together?"
I admitted I had not. I was frankly out of my depth, but he had certainly brought me to the most unchristian spot I had ever been in my life. His nursing home, however, was in delightful contrast to the wild and barren country that surrounded it. The garden was a mass of colour, and the house, old and rambling and covered with creepers, as charming within as without. It reminded me of the East. It reminded me of the Renaissance, and yet it had no style save that of warm, rich colouring and comfort. I soon settled down to my job, which I found exceedingly interesting. As I have already said, Taverner's work began where ordinary medicine ended, and I had under my care cases such as the ordinary doctor would have referred to the safe keeping of an asylum as being nothing else but mad. Yet Taverner, by his peculiar methods of work, laid bare causes operating both within the soul and in the shadowy realm where the soul has its dwelling, that threw an entirely new light upon the problem
and often enabled him to rescue a man from the dark influences that were closing in upon him. The affair of the sheep killing was an interesting example of his methods. Part 2. One showery afternoon at the nursing home, we had a call from a neighbour. Not a very common occurrence, for Taverner and his ways were regarded somewhat askance. Our visitor shed her dripping mackintosh, but declined to loosen the scarf which, warm as the day was, she had twisted tightly round her neck.
"I believe you specialise in mental cases," she said to my colleague. "I should very much like to talk over with you a matter that is troubling me."
Taverner nodded, his keen eyes watching her for symptoms.
"It concerns a friend of mine. In fact, I think I may call him my fiancé, for although he has asked me to release him from his engagement, I've refused to do so, not because I should wish to hold a man who no longer loved me, but because I am convinced that he still cares for me, and there is something which has come between us that he will not tell me of. I have begged him to be frank with me and let us share the trouble together, for the thing that seems an insuperable obstacle to him may not appear in that light to me. But you know what men are when they consider their honour is in question."
She looked from one to the other of us, smiling. No woman ever believes that her menfolk are grown up. Perhaps she is right. Then she leant forward and clasped her hands eagerly.
"I believe I have found the key to the mystery. I want you to tell me whether it is possible or not."
"Will you give me particulars?" said Taverner. Clearly and concisely, she gave us what was required.
"We got engaged while Donald was stationed here for his training. That would be nearly 5 years ago now. And there was always the most perfect harmony between us until he came out of the army, and we all began to notice a change in him. He came to the house as often as ever, but he always seemed to want to avoid being alone with me. We used to take long walks over the moors together, but he has absolutely refused to do this recently. Then, without any warning, he wrote and told me he could not marry me and did not wish to see me again. Oh, and he put a curious thing in his letter. He said, 'Even if I should come to you and ask you to see me, I beg you not to do it.' My people thought he had got entangled with some other girl and were furious with him for jilting me, but I believe there is something more in it than that. I wrote to him, but could get no answer, and I had come to the conclusion that I must try and put the whole thing out of my life when he suddenly turned up again. Now, this is where the queer part comes in. We heard the fowls shrieking one night and thought a fox was after them. My brothers turned out armed with golf clubs, and I went too. When we got to the hen house, we found several fowls with their throats torn as if a rat had been at them, but the boys discovered that the hen house had been forced open, a thing no rat could do. They said a gypsy must have been trying to steal the birds and told me to go back to the house. I was returning by way of the shrubberies when someone suddenly stepped out in front of me. It was quite light, for the moon was nearly full, and I recognized Donald. He held out his arms, and I went to him, but instead of kissing me, he suddenly bent his head and... Look!"
She drew her scarf from her neck and showed us a semicircle of little blue marks on the skin just under the ear, the unmistakable print of human teeth.
"He was after the jugular," said Taverner. "Lucky for you, he did not break the skin."
I said to him, "Donald, what are you doing?"
My voice seemed to bring him to himself, for he let me go and tore off through the bushes. The boys chased him, but did not catch him, and we have never seen him since.
"You informed the police, I suppose," said Taverner.
"Father told them someone had tried to rob the hen roost, but they do not know who it was. You see, I did not tell them I had seen Donald."
"And you walk about the moors by yourself, knowing that he may be lurking in the neighbourhood?"
She nodded.
"I should advise you not to, Miss Winter. The man is probably exceedingly dangerous, especially to you. We will send you back in the car."
"You think he's gone mad? That's exactly what I think. I believe he knew he was going mad, and that was why he broke off our engagement. Dr. Taverner, is there nothing that can be done for him? It seems to me that Donald is not mad in the ordinary way. We had a housemaid once who went off her head, and the whole of her seemed to be insane, if you can understand. But with Donald, it seems as if only a little bit of him were crazy, as if his insanity were outside himself. Can you grasp what I mean?"
It seems to me you have given a very clear description of a case of psychic interference, what was known in scriptural days as being possessed by a devil, said Taverner.
Can you do anything for him?
The girl inquired eagerly. May be able to do a good deal if you can get him to come to me.
On our next day at the Harley Street consulting room, we found that the butler had booked an appointment for a Captain Donald Craigie. We discovered him to be a personality of singular charm, one of those highly strung, imaginative men who have the makings of an artist in them. In his normal state, he must have been a delightful companion, but as he faced us across the consulting room desk, he was a man under a cloud.
"I may as well make a clean breast of this matter," he said. "I suppose Beryl told you about their chickens."
"She told us that you tried to bite her."
"Did she tell you about the chickens?"
"No."
"Well, I did."
Silence fell for a moment, then Taverner broke it.
"When did this trouble first start?"
"After I got shell shock. I was blown right out of a trench, and it shook me up pretty badly. I thought I'd got off lightly, for I was only in hospital about 10 days. But I suppose this is the aftermath."
"Are you one of those people who have a horror of blood?"
"Not especially so. I didn't like it, but I could put up with it. We had to get used to it in the trenches. Someone was always getting wounded, even in the quietest times."
"And killed?" put in Taverner.
"Yes, and killed," said our patient.
"So you developed a blood hunger?"
"That's about it."
"Underdone meat and all the rest of it, I suppose?"
"No, that's of no use to me. Seems a horrible thing to say, but it is fresh blood that attracts me, blood as it comes from the veins of my victim."
"Ah," said Taverner. "That puts a different complexion on the case."
"I shouldn't have thought it could have been much blacker."
"On the contrary, what you've just told me renders the outlook much more hopeful. You have not so much a bloodlust, which might well be an effect of the subconscious mind, as a vitality hunger, which is quite a different matter."
Craigie looked up quickly.
"That's exactly it. I've never been able to put it into words before, but you've hit the nail on the head."
I saw that my colleague's perspicuity had given him great confidence.
"I should like you to come down to my nursing home for a time and be under my personal observation," said Taverner.
"I should like to very much, but I think there is something further you ought to know before I do so. This thing has begun to affect my character. At first it seemed something outside myself, but now I'm responding to it, almost helping, and trying to find out ways of gratifying it without getting myself into trouble. That is why I went in for the hens when I came down to the Winter's house. I was afraid I should lose my self-control and go for Beryl. I did in the end, as it happened, so it was not much use. In fact, I think it did more harm than good, for I seemed to get into much closer touch with it after I'd yielded to the impulse. I know that the best thing I could do would be to do away with myself, but I didn't. I feel that after I'm dead, I should have to meet whatever it is face to face."
"You need not be afraid to come down to the nursing home," said Taverner. "We will look after you."
After he had gone, Taverner said to me,
"Have you ever heard of vampires, Rhodes?"
"Yes, rather," I said. "I used to read myself to sleep with Dracula once when I had a spell of insomnia."
"That," nodding his head in the direction of the departing man, "is a singularly good specimen."
"Do you mean to say you're going to take a revolting case like that down to Hindhead?"
"Not revolting, Rhodes. A soul in a dungeon. The soul may not be very savory, but it is a fellow creature. Let it out, and it will soon clean itself."
I often used to marvel at the wonderful tolerance and compassion Taverner had for erring humanity.
"The more you see of human nature," he said to me once, "the less you feel inclined to condemn it, for you realize how hard it has struggled. No one does wrong because he likes it, but because it is the lesser of the two evils."
Part 3. A couple of days later, I was called out of the nursing home office to receive a new patient. It was Craigie. He had got as far as the doormat, and there he had stuck.
He seemed so thoroughly ashamed of himself that I had not the heart to administer the judicious bullying which is usual under such circumstances. "I feel as if I were driving a balking horse," he said. "I want to come in, but I can't." I called Taverner, and the sight of him seemed to relieve our patient. "Ah," he said, "you give me confidence. I feel that I can defy it." And he squared his shoulders and crossed the threshold. Once inside, a weight seemed lifted from his mind, and he settled down quite happily to the routine of the place. Beryl Winter used to walk over almost every afternoon, unknown to her family, and cheer him up. In fact, he seemed on the high road to recovery. One morning I was strolling round the grounds with the head gardener, planning certain small improvements, when he made a remark to me which I had reason to remember later. "You would think all the German prisoners should have been returned by now, wouldn't you, sir? But they haven't. I passed one the other night in the lane outside a back door. I never thought that I should see their filthy field grey again." I sympathised with his antipathy. He had been a prisoner in their hands, and the memory was not one to fade. I thought no more of his remark, but a few days later I was reminded of it when one of our patients came to me and said, "Dr. Rhodes, I think you are exceedingly unpatriotic to employ German prisoners in the garden when so many discharged soldiers cannot get work." I assured her that we did not do so, no German being likely to survive a day's work under the superintendence of our ex-prisoner head gardener. "But I distinctly saw the man going round the greenhouses at shutting up time last night," she declared. "I recognized him by his flat cap and grey uniform." I mentioned this to Taverner. "Tell Craigie he is on no account to go out after sundown," he said. "And tell Miss Winter she had better keep away for the present." A night or two later, as I was strolling round the grounds, smoking an after-dinner cigarette, I met Craigie hurrying through the shrubbery. "You will have Dr. Taverner on your trail," I called after him. "I missed the postbag," he replied, "and I'm going down to the pillar box." Next evening, I again found Craigie in the grounds after dark. I bore down on him. "Look here, Craigie," I said. "If you come to this place, you must keep the rules, and Dr. Taverner wants you to stay indoors after sundown." Craigie bared his teeth and snarled at me like a dog. I took him by the arm and marched him into the house. Reported the incident to Taverner. "The creature has re-established its influence over him," he said. "We cannot evidently starve it out of existence by keeping it away from him. We shall have to use other methods. Where is Craigie at the present moment?"
"Playing the piano in the drawing room," I replied.
"Then we will go up to his room and unseal it."
As I followed Taverner upstairs, he said to me,
"Did it ever occur to you to wonder why Craigie jibbed on the doorstep?"
"I paid no attention," I said. "Such a thing is common enough with mental cases."
"There is a sphere of influence, a kind of psychic bell jar over this house to keep out evil entities, what might in popular language be called a spell. Craigie's familiar could not come inside and did not like being left behind. Thought we might be able to tire it out by keeping Craigie away from its influences, but it has got too strong a hold over him, and he deliberately cooperates with it. Evil communications corrupt good manners, and you can't keep company with a thing like that and not be tainted, especially if you are a sensitive Celt like Craigie."
When we reached the room, Taverner went over to the window and passed his hand across the sill, as if sweeping something aside.
"There," he said. "It can come in now and fetch him out, and we will see what it does."
At the doorway he paused again and made a sign on the lintel.
"I don't think it will pass that," he said.
When I returned to the office, I found the village policeman waiting to see me.
"I should be glad if you would keep an eye on your dog, sir," he said. "We have been having complaints of sheep killing lately, and whatever animal is doing it is working in a 3-mile radius, with this as the center."
"Our dog is an Airedale," I said. "I should not think he is likely to be guilty. It is usually collies that take to sheep killing." At 11 o'clock we turned out the lights and herded our patients off to bed. At Taverner's request, I changed into an old suit and rubber-soled tennis shoes and joined him in the smoking room, which was under Craigie's bedroom.
We sat in the darkness, awaiting events.
"I don't want you to do anything," said Taverner, "but just to follow and see what happens."
We had not long to wait. In about a quarter of an hour, we heard a rustling in the creepers, and down came Craigie hand over fist, swinging himself along by the great ropes of wisteria that clothed the wall. As he disappeared into the shrubbery, I slipped after him, keeping in the shadow of the house. He moved at a stealthy dog trot over the heather paths towards Frensham. At first I ran and ducked, taking advantage of every patch of shadow, but presently I saw that this caution was unnecessary. Craigie was absorbed in his own affairs, and thereupon I drew up closer to him, following at a distance of some 60 yards. He moved at a swinging pace, a kind of loping trot that put me in mind of a bloodhound. The wide, empty levels of that forsaken country stretched out on either side of us. Belts of mist filled the hollows, and the heights of Hindhead stood out against the stars. I felt no nervousness. Man for man, I reckoned I was a match for Craigie, and, in addition, I was armed with what is technically known as a soother. 2 feet of lead gas piping inserted in a length of rubber hose pipe. It is not included in the official equipment of the best asylums, but can frequently be found in a keeper's trouser leg. If I had known what I had to deal with, I should not have put so much reliance on my soother. Ignorance is sometimes an excellent substitute for courage. Suddenly, out of the heather ahead of us, a sheep got up. Then the chase began. Away went Craigie in pursuit, and away went the terrified wether. A sheep can move remarkably fast for a short distance, but the poor wool-encumbered beast could not keep the pace, and Craigie ran it down, working in gradually lessening circles. It stumbled, went to its knees, and he was on it. He pulled its head back, and whether he used a knife or not I could not see, for a cloud passed over the moon, but dimly luminous in the shadow, I saw something that was semi-transparent pass between me and the dark, struggling mass among the heather. As the moon cleared the clouds, I made out the flat-topped cap and field-grey uniform of the German army. I cannot possibly convey the sickening horror of that sight. The creature that was not a man assisting the man who, for the moment, was not human. Gradually, the sheep's struggles weakened and ceased. Craigie straightened his back and stood up. Then he set off at his steady lope towards the east, his grey familiar at his heels. How I made the homeward journey, I do not know. I dared not look behind lest I should find a presence at my elbow. Every breath of wind that blew across the heather seemed to be cold fingers on my throat. Fir trees reached out long arms to clutch me as I passed under them, and heather bushes rose up and assumed human shapes. I moved like a runner in a nightmare, making prodigious efforts after a receding goal. At last I tore across the moonlit lawns of the house, regardless who might be looking from the windows, burst into the smoking room and flung myself face downwards on the sofa. Part 4.
"Tut, tut," said Taverner. "Has it been as bad as all that?"
I could not tell him what I had seen, but he seemed to know.
"Which way did Craigie go after he left you?"
he asked. "Towards the moonrise," I told him.
"And you were on the way to Frensham?" "He is heading for the Winter's house. This is very serious roads. We must go after him. It may be too late as it is. Do you feel equal to coming with me?"
He gave me a stiff glass of brandy, and we went to get the car out of the garage. In Taverner's company, I felt secure. I could understand the confidence he inspired in his patients. Whatever that grey shadow might be, I felt he could deal with it and that I should be safe in his hands. We were not long in approaching our destination.
"I think we will leave the car here," said Taverner,
turning into a grass-grown lane.
"We do not want to rouse them if we can help it."
We moved cautiously over the dew-soaked grass into the paddock that bounded one side of the Winter's garden. It was separated from the lawn by a sunk fence, and we could command the whole front of the house and easily gain the terrace if we so desired. In the shadow of a rose pergola we paused. The great trusses of bloom, colourless in the moonlight, seemed a ghastly mockery of our business. For some time we waited, and then a movement caught my eye. Out in the meadow behind us, something was moving at a slow lope. It followed a wide arc, of which the house formed the focus, and disappeared into a little coppice on the left. It might have been imagination, but I thought I saw a wisp of mist at its heels. We remained where we were, and presently he came round once more, this time moving in a smaller circle, evidently closing in upon the house. The third time he reappeared more quickly, and this time he was between us and the terrace.
"Quick, head him off," whispered Taverner. "He will be up the creepers next round."
We scrambled up the sunk fence and dashed across the lawn. As we did so, a girl's figure appeared at one of the windows. It was Beryl Winter. Taverner, plainly visible in the moonlight, laid his finger on his lips and beckoned her to come down.
"I am going to do a very risky thing," he whispered. "But she is a girl of courage, and if her nerve does not fail, we shall be able to pull it off."
In a few seconds, she slipped out of a side door and joined us, a cloak over her nightdress.
"Are you prepared to undertake an exceedingly unpleasant task?" Taverner asked her. "I can guarantee you will be perfectly safe so long as you keep your head, but if you lose your nerve, you will be in grave danger."
"Is it to do with Donald?" she inquired.
"It is," said Taverner. "I hope to be able to rid him of the thing that is overshadowing him and trying to obsess him."
"I have seen it," she said. "It's like a wisp of grey vapour that floats just behind him. It has the most awful face you ever saw. It came up to the window last night, just the face only, while Donald was going round and round the house."
"What did you do?" asked Taverner.
"I didn't do anything. I was afraid that if someone found him, he might be put in an asylum, and then we should have no chance of getting him well."
Taverner nodded. "Perfect love casteth out fear," he said. "You can do the thing that is required of you."
He placed Miss Winter on the terrace in full moonlight.
"As soon as Craigie sees you," he said, "retreat round the corner of the house into the yard. Rhodes and I will wait for you there."
A narrow doorway led from the terrace to the back premises, and just inside its arch, Taverner bade me take my stand.
"Pinion him as he comes past you and hang on for your life," he said. "Only mind he doesn't get his teeth into you. These things are infectious."
We had hardly taken up our positions when we heard the loping trot come round once more, this time on the terrace itself. Evidently he caught sight of Miss Winter, for the stealthy padding changed to a wild scurry over the gravel, and the girl slipped quickly through the archway and sought refuge behind Taverner. Right on her heels came Craigie. Another yard and he would have had her, but I caught him by the elbows and pinioned him securely. For a moment we swayed and struggled across the dew-drenched flagstones, but I locked him in an old wrestling grip and held him.
"Now," said Taverner, "if you will keep hold of Craigie, I will deal with the other. But first of all, we must get it away from him. Otherwise, it will retreat onto him, and he may die of shock. Now, Miss Winter, are you prepared to play your part?"
"I am prepared to do whatever is necessary," she replied. Taverner took a scalpel out of a pocket case and made a small incision in the skin of her neck, just under the ear. A drop of blood slowly gathered, showing black in the moonlight.
"That is the bait," he said. "Now go close up to Craigie and entice the creature away. Get it to follow you and draw it out into the open."
As she approached us, Craigie plunged and struggled in my arms like a wild beast. And then something grey and shadowy drew out of the gloom of the wall and hovered for a moment at my elbow. Miss Winter came nearer, walking almost into it.
"Don't get too close,"
cried Taverner, and she paused. Then the grey shape seemed to make up its mind. It drew clear of Craigie and advanced towards her. She retreated towards Taverner, and the thing came out into the moonlight. We could see it quite clearly from its flat-topped cap to its knee-boots. Its high cheekbones and slit eyes pointed its origin to that southeastern corner of Europe where strange tribes still defy civilization and keep up their still stranger beliefs. The shadowy form drifted onwards, following the girl across the yard, and when it was some 20 feet from Craigie, Taverner stepped out quickly behind it, cutting off its retreat. Round it came in a moment, instantly conscious of his presence, and then began a game of puss in the corner. Taverner was trying to drive it into a kind of psychic killing pen he had made for its reception. Invisible to me, the lines of psychic force which bounded it were evidently plainly perceptible to the creature we were hunting. This way and that way it slid in its efforts to escape, but Taverner all the time herded it towards the apex of the invisible triangle, where he could give it its coup de grace. Then the end came. Taverner leapt forward. There was a sign, then a sound. The grey form commenced to spin like a top. Faster and faster it went, its outlines merging into a whirling spiral of mist. Then it broke. Out into space went the particles that had composed its form, and with the almost soundless shriek of supreme speed, the soul went to its appointed place. Then something seemed to lift. From a cold hell of limitless horror, the flagged space became a normal backyard. The trees ceased to be tentacled menaces. The gloom of the wall was no longer an ambuscade, and I knew that never again would a grey shadow drift out of the darkness upon its horrible hunting. I released Craigie, who collapsed in a heap at my feet. Miss Winter went to rouse her father, while Taverner and I got the insensible man into the house. What masterly lies Taverner told to the family I have never known. But a couple of months later we received, instead of the conventional fragment of wedding cake, a really substantial chunk, with a note from the bride to say it was to go in the office cupboard, where she knew we kept provisions for those nocturnal meals that Taverner's peculiar habits imposed upon us. It was during one of those midnight repasts that I questioned Taverner about the strange matter of Craigie and his familiar. For a long time I had not been able to refer to it. The memory of that horrible sheep-killing was a thing that would not bear recalling.
"You have heard of vampires," said Taverner. "That was a typical case. For close on 100 years they have been practically unknown in Europe. Western Europe, that is. But the war has caused a renewed outbreak, and quite a number of cases have been reported. When they were first observed, that is to say, when some wretched lad was caught attacking the wounded, they took him behind the lines and shot him, which is not a satisfactory way of dealing with a vampire, unless you also go to the trouble of burning his body, according to the good old-fashioned way of dealing with practitioners of black magic. Then our enlightened generation came to the conclusion that they were not dealing with a crime, but with a disease, and put the unfortunate individual afflicted with this horrible obsession into an asylum, where he did not usually live very long, the supply of his peculiar nourishment being cut off. But it never struck anybody that they might be dealing with more than one factor, that what they were really contending with was a gruesome partnership between the dead and the living."
"What in the world do you mean?" I asked.
"We have two physical bodies, you know," said Taverner. "The dense material one, with which we are all familiar, and the subtle etheric one, which inhabits it and acts as the medium of the life forces, whose functioning would explain a very great deal if science would only condescend to investigate it. When a man dies, the etheric body, with his soul in it, draws out of the physical form and drifts about in its neighborhood for about 3 days, or until decomposition sets in, and then the soul draws out of the etheric body also, which in turn dies, and the man enters upon the first phase of his post-mortem existence, the purgatorial one. Now, it is possible to keep the etheric body together almost indefinitely if a supply of vitality is available, but having no stomach which can digest food and turn it into energy, the thing has to batten on someone who has, and develops into a spirit parasite, which we call a vampire. There is a pretty good working knowledge of black magic in Eastern Europe. Now, supposing some man who has this knowledge gets shot, he knows that in 3 days' time, at the death of the etheric body, he will have to face his reckoning, and with his record he naturally does not want to do it. So
he establishes a connection with the subconscious mind of some other soul that still has a body, provided he can find one suitable for his purposes. A very positive type of character is useless. He has to find one of a negative type, such as the lower class of medium affords. Hence, one of the many dangers of mediumship to the untrained. Such a negative condition may be temporarily induced by, say, shell shock, and it is possible then for such a soul as we are considering to obtain an influence over a being of much higher type, Craigie, for instance, and use him as a means of obtaining its gratification.
But why did not the creature confine its attentions to Craigie instead of causing him to attack others?